My guest on Takes on the World today, Sarah Stillman, is a staff writer for New Yorker, won a National Magazine Award for her reporting from Iraq and Afghanistan on labor abuses, and a George Polk Award for her work on confidential informants. In the August 12th and 19th edition of The New Yorker, she wrote a lengthy and rather frightening essay entitled Taken, The Shocking Injustices of Civil Forfeiture, and Shocking and Unjust They Are Indeed. My pleasure to welcome Sarah Stillman to Takes on the World.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm glad you are here. It's an amazing article. In recent weeks, we've had one revelation after another about the extent to which government surveillance on our day-to-day lives has gutted privacy positions of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. Now, in your article, you've described an assault of the Protection of Property Clause of the Fourth Amendment that probably has had more direct effect on the lives of Americans than has the NSA surveillance, at least at this point in time. How widespread is this problem of civil asset forfeiture, and what are its implications for the future?
Well, I mean, it varies tremendously from state to state, and that's, you know, one of the main issues I talk about in the piece is that it's a policy that, you know, has looked really different at different places and points in time. So, you know, the federal government actually did a lot to reconsider some of its policies that had been widely abused after they had sort of come about in the Reagan-era war on drugs. And that didn't always sort of trickle down to the state and local level. So what I saw in reporting the piece around the country was that in certain spots, hot spots like Philadelphia, where I wrote about people's homes being seized, who weren't even being accused of a crime, but who, you know, in some instances had children or grandchildren who had been accused but not convicted of minor drug crimes, and the homes were being seized by the Commonwealth. I mean, you see manifestations like that, but it really depends on kind of exactly what area you're talking about.
I know we've had that, particularly in public housing projects. When I lived in San Francisco, if someone was using drugs, and you actually mentioned that in a story elsewhere, that someone, let's say, a grandmother was living in an apartment, but a grandson was there and was caught with drugs, the apartment would be forfeited. The person, the grandmother, would lose her apartment. One of the things you point out is certain places that were really abusing this particular situation. One was Tenaha, Texas. And the ACLU won a lawsuit last year against Tenaha, but they were stopping just about everybody. And actually, ironically, it was led by a black policeman.
Exactly. It was a pretty small town in Texas, a very small town, in fact, but it was situated along a major highway. It was 59 that basically takes you from Mexico all the way north to Canada, and it's, you know, it's certainly a very real problem of, you know, drug trafficking going along that highway, but it passes through this very small town, and essentially what was happening is that hundreds, perhaps even thousands of cars were being pulled over, usually out-of-state people who were found to fit a certain profile, for instance, you know, people who were driving rental cars, this was disproportionately targeting people who were black or Latino. They were being pulled over and basically, in many instances, asked, you know, do you have any drugs in the car? And if people said no, you know, do you have any cash in the car? And in a case I document in the story of a couple that was driving through the town with their two children, they were asked those questions. It was found that they did have cash, but no actual contraband was found in the car, just a large sum of cash they said they were taking to buy a used car. And they were basically told, you know, you can be sent to prison tonight, we'll take your kids to foster care and press money laundering charges against you, or ultimately you can just sign away your right to the cash, we'll take the cash and use it for law enforcement purposes, and you can drive on down the road unperturbed. So that was just one of many examples that was found in Tenaha of people being having their money confiscated without really any due process, without any charges that were proved in court against them, and often without any contraband found in the car.
When you point out the differences between criminal forfeiture and civil forfeiture, perhaps you could explain those to the listeners.
Yeah, you know, I think that's really important to make clear from the get-go, because I had been familiar with, and I think most people are familiar with and sort of supportive of, the notion of criminal forfeiture, this idea that, you know, if you are found to be profiting from criminal activity, then, you know, you may lose the things that you've bought with the proceeds of those crimes, whether it be, you know, your Bernie Madoff and you've been, you've got a great mansion and a yacht and all of that, or a drug trafficker, or in many cases it's been used against white-collar crime and actually has been a way of kind of returning the proceeds of crimes to the victims of those crimes, which, again, makes a lot of intuitive sense. What I had not known about was this whole world of civil forfeiture, where instead of bringing a case against a person who's committed a crime and proving them, once they're proven guilty, taking their stuff, you're actually bringing a case directly against a piece of property, which does not enjoy the same rights as a citizen. So it sounds confusing, but it's basically, you know, U.S. government versus $6,000, or state of Texas versus a car or a piece of jewelry. And so a lot of the conventional notions of rights are sort of turned on their heads in this process. And I think one of the most surprising to people is that because you're not entitled to a lawyer, and because, you know, a lot of the other conventions of, you know, being innocent until proven guilty are not the case in many states, you can lose your stuff without even having been convicted of a crime in court.
I notice you have a couple of examples here. The United States versus one pearl necklace. The United States versus approximately 64,695 pounds of shark fins. So in the case of a pearl necklace, if you're the owner, you can't have there's nothing you can do in this case?
Well, you know, I think it's important to point out, I mean, this has been a tool that's been used against, you know, people who have committed serious crimes. But in cases like, you know, the jeweler being confiscated in Panama, what you were seeing is people who were actually being pressured, essentially, in some cases, being pressured even that they might lose their children or that they would go to jail for a very long time when there was no substantial proof against them that could have actually resulted in a criminal conviction. So one interesting thing that I found is that actually many people who did contest, most of the time in the cases in Tenaha, when people actually pushed back, when they got a lawyer and spent their own money to try to defend themselves, they actually got their property back immediately or in a very quick time, which, you know, their lawyers then argued was sort of a sign that there wasn't really a legal leg to stand on there. I think the point is that the system has, in those cases where it's being abused, really gone after people who don't necessarily have the resources or the wherewithal to fight back. I talked about a number of cases in Washington, D.C., for instance, where you actually have to pay a substantial sum simply for the right to contest a forfeiture. So, you know, for instance, I wrote about a woman, Nelly Marrera, in D.C., whose son had been driving her car and had been pulled over and found to have an illegal handgun. And so Ms. Marrera's car was taken, and she learned, I believe it was about 2 weeks later, she got a letter in the mail saying that she had to pay something like $1,500 for the right to contest. Otherwise, the car would be seized automatically and put to use by the city or auctioned off by the city. So you can see why, you know, a lot of the challenges really come into play when it's about how do you even begin to contest what can be a very, very kind of confusing process. So I think the fundamental issue at stake here is, you know, if people are guilty of a crime and have reaped the benefits of that crime, then go through the normal legal process that we have established for kind of convicting someone of a crime and proving that charge before property is taken, which in many states right now is not exactly the case.
You point out that by and large, the majority of people, or an inordinate amount, percentage of the people who are victimized by this civil forfeiture are Black and Latino.
Right. Again, that's another thing that looks sort of different depending on where you are in the country. So I just want to emphasize that. But in the town that I wrote about in Tenaha, they found that, you know, once this drug interdiction program was started up, the racial demographics of who was being pulled over, mostly on, you know, what's known as pretextual traffic stops, so sort of minor traffic violations like driving too long in the left-hand lane, or you know, things like having a having the wrong turn signals or things like that. And this was distinctly targeting people of color, which was also the case in Philadelphia, where the material I wrote about home seizures there. The people, the lawyers who've been working on that issue there argue that there's been a very clear kind of disproportionate impact on minorities.
There was one moving story which actually turned out not as bad as it started. The case of a El Salvadoran immigrant, Victor Ramos Guzman, a Pentecostal church secretary from El Salvador, who was on his way in Virginia to buy a parcel of land for the church and had $28,500 in the glove compartment. That was donations from the parishioners to buy the land, and that was seized. But they did get it back from someone who actually had been involved working for the government before that.
Exactly, someone who had actually been in the Reagan administration helping to run the forfeiture program, who ultimately, despite the fact that he was kind of one of the architects of that initial sort of creation of sort of modern forfeiture, he has since become a person on kind of the opposite side of it. He's basically representing, I believe, for free most of the time, people who have, he believes, been kind of wrongly targeted by these policies without due process. And there's quite a number of people, actually, who initially helped conceive of this idea as a meaningful way to combat what were kind of very real and serious crimes, and instead believed that, you know, without the right regulations in place, that in some cases this has led to some pretty serious abuses.
I would guess that statistics on the number of people who have lost property under this civil forfeiture, this legalized stealing, are pretty murky, because I would suspect most people don't even report it.
Right. I mean, a lot of the forfeitures, a pretty huge proportion, are people who don't contest and their goods are seized automatically. And so, of course, you know, a good number of those people are people who presumably were involved in money laundering or drug trafficking and didn't want to contest because they didn't necessarily want to expose what they were doing. They just wanted to be able to go on their way, which is another actual critique of forfeiture that I write about in the piece that some people have brought up, which is, you know, for instance, one thing that was happening in Tenaha, Texas, was that when they did find a car that was full of drugs and cash, they made a similar deal where basically they said, you know, even though we found you trafficking a huge amount of cocaine, you have all this money. If you sign that over, basically we'll let you drive on and we will never press criminal charges against you. So, you know, it again begs the question, and it's true also in the case you just mentioned of Victor Guzman, the Pentecostal church secretary, you know, if it was true that he was, you know, trafficking in drugs or money, then you would think that there would be sort of a legal process to go about proving those claims and going after that, as opposed to simply saying, okay, well, let's just strike a deal here that's beneficial for both of us and let you go on your way, which, again, you know, a lot of people who've been working on this issue for quite some time now, groups like the Institute for Justice, have looked at the way that the sort of profit structure or the sort of proceeds of these forfeitures are often used in many states where there aren't really clear regulations about that, where essentially in places like Tenaha, this cash is seized and then it often goes directly back into law enforcement's, not only their daily operations, but in the case of that town, it was being used to give personal bonuses to officers. It was being used to have the district attorney buy candy and Halloween costumes and things for parades that may have been sort of related to re-election campaigns. So, you know, a lot of the other issues that people have raised or questions that people have raised about forfeiture policy actually have to do with the sort of second half of the equation, which is, you know, what actually happens with the goods that are seized and the money that's seized, and the question of, does that create kind of perverse incentives?
Well, certainly with decreasing budgets and economic pressures, it would seem like a lure for law enforcement agencies to exploit this civil forfeiture to take care of shortfalls in their budget. I do know in Mendocino County here, the amount of money in civic forfeitures has more than tripled in the last 4 years. And of course, Mendocino County is known for its, besides its vineyards, it's also its other horticulture. And so obviously this is one way to keep the courts free and the finances of the district attorney's office and the police agencies better prepared or provided for when the money is not there from the taxpayers.
Right. It's very easy to understand kind of how that would be a real incentive if you're able, especially in a time of immense budget strains, if you're able to kind of supplement your budget through this mechanism. It makes a lot of sense that that might drive kind of policing priorities.
Do you see how this seems to tie, or do you see a tie-in with this NSA surveillance I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that we seem to be losing more and more of our constitutional rights? Of course, they weren't original constitutional rights. They were the Bill of Rights, and they were fought for. But do you see the connection between the NSA surveillance and the civil forfeiture, or is this just a circumstantial coincidence?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's not something I've thought much about, but I think in terms of sort of increasing ways in which kind of police presence manifests in American daily lives, I think there's presumably a connection in terms of the kind of the degree to which many Americans have just come to feel like that these policies are normalized. Like, for instance, in doing a follow-up piece on the forfeiture story, I did a web piece for The New Yorker on sort of the militarization of policing, and that's something a lot of people have been doing some great writing about. People like Radley Dockel has a new book on the issue, and looking at how I was quite shocked, actually, when I saw the statistics about SWAT team raids and the rates at which they've increased from the 1970s, when you were seeing just a few hundred raids a year of people's homes, most of the time being justified in cases where police were facing very real dangers and threats raiding the home, and then seeing that the rates go up to something like 80,000 in the past year, so such a enormous increase in these sort of militarized tactics in people's homes in the war on drugs. I mean, I think in some ways it has some overlap with some of what you're seeing in the more kind of international sphere of American policy, but it's something, I'll definitely give some more thought to that, because it's not something I'd necessarily thought deeply enough about.
I'm really happy to have had you for these 20 minutes. I think this is a really important issue, and I know a number of people in the county here are interested in that issue and listening to it, hear about what's happening on a national scale. Mike, Sarah Stillman, thank you so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World, and continue your fine reporting.
And thank you so much for having me on the show and for tackling this issue. I really appreciate it.
We are going to go in just a moment to speak with Ipan Thampi, who is the executive director of the Americans for Forfeiture Freedom, who has been, this is it's a website that has been following and defending and trying to get laws changed that would eliminate this attack on our Fourth Amendment rights. We do have our guest, Ipan Thampi, on the phone. You're the executive director of American for Forfeiture Freedom. Welcome to Takes on the World.
Glad to be here.
I don't know if you had a chance to listen online. I was just interviewing Susan Stillman, who wrote that article in New Yorker, which you actually referenced on your website. I was just giving a little bit of background about American for Forfeiture Freedom. Tell a bit about the organization, what you've been doing.
At Americans with Forfeiture Reform, we have a couple specific missions. Our ultimate mission is to abolish civil asset forfeiture in the United States at the state and federal level and reform the criminal forfeiture laws that have also been weakened. As part of her, on a day-to-day basis, we research and evaluate developments in forfeiture law. We reach out to victims or victims reach out to us. We facilitate the right legal contacts for people who are fighting forfeiture actions in court. So we help people find the right attorney, which is uniquely an issue for people facing forfeiture claims. We also support appellate litigation. We're working on a amicus brief in the Tenth Circuit at the moment.
What I found interesting is that I had brought it up with Sarah Stillman, but the connection between the NSA surveillance, and asset forfeiture, and
that's something. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. Go ahead. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, that's something that really has not been really well understood. You know, a lot of, and especially, you know, a lot of people have this kind of attitude. Well, how does NSA surveillance, you know, hurt me? A lot of people don't understand what that means on a, you know, individual basis. But the forfeiture system gives the government a way to profit from its overwhelming surveillance capability and essentially profit in secret. And it's a particular concern because civil asset forfeiture is a civil, not a criminal process. I guess I should mention that the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers last week or 2 weeks ago put out a statement where they said the use of DEA and other government agencies to essentially create secret investigations as a means of introducing, you know, investigations into the criminal justice system flies in the face of, you know, hundreds of years of established constitutional law protections, you know. But what's and they're talking about people who get prosecuted for a crime, federal or state. But one of the things that they don't talk about is that you don't have to be even charged or convicted of a crime to have your property seized and potentially forfeited. Under civil forfeiture, the government treats your property as a legal person. So you have these bizarre court cases, United States federal government versus $100,000 in cash, or United States federal government against, you know, 1812 Winslow Lane, you know, being a home, or United States federal government versus one 1984, you know, Chevy Sebring or whatever, you know. You have, this is a very serious issue, especially when the Department of Justice is now seizing, you know, north of $4 billion a year through civil forfeiture. And keep in mind, you know, this is money. The proceeds of civil forfeiture don't go back to the general fund. Congress doesn't touch it. It goes back to a special fund for the Department of Justice or the DEA. So they can basically create this fund of revenue and spend it, you know, more or less as they please. It's a massive slush fund, you know, and it's one of the key economic engines of the push to expand, you know, government power, you know, that began really with the war on drugs, you know, and has found, you know, and of course, you know, up in Mendocino, you folks are probably very interested in the federal government's use of forfeiture to prosecute marijuana cultivators or people, you know, in that industry, you know, despite, you know, the different state and local laws, you know. So the civil forfeiture system gives the government a massive slush fund incentive to do things like that, to push for more power. And now we're seeing, you know, kind of the end results of, you know, what we started 40 years ago. We started the war on drugs, and now it's kind of expanded into a much, much bigger thing, to the point where it's not even, I mean, it never really was about drugs. It was about money and power. So, you know, the civil forfeiture system is that system, as bold as it gets.
Well, it's interesting. You have an article on your website how the NSA, you have a, you cite an article in the Houston Chronicle, the NSA is handing the Justice Department information derived from a secret electronic eavesdropping programs about suspected criminal activity unrelated to terrorism. And so this, of course, includes allegations about sexual offenses, but also and corporate criminal activity, but also whatever kind of activity that local police enforcement might make use of.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we get a lot of contacts from forfeiture victims, and this is the scenario. You know, they're driving from, you know, state A to state B with a large amount of cash. They get stopped. The law enforcement agent decides to search, gets a drug dog controller, and seems to know exactly where, you know, to find the cash, or that they're carrying something that makes them worth stopping in the first place. You know, and state, local, and federal law enforcement use the system to generate enormous profits from highway stops. You know, you don't have to be carrying drugs. You don't have to be carrying any illegal contraband. You don't have to be arrested or ticketed in a highway stop. But if you have cash, they can initiate a civil asset forfeiture of that money. And you have to prove, essentially, that your money is innocent of any criminal activity. You know, and once we get that drug dog to alert on it, they'll say your money has drug residue on it, which, of course, we know that's a completely bogus claim. But, you know, to go back to the NSA, you know, a lot of these cases, there is no reason, absolutely no reason why, you know, some certain people would be targeted for highway stops, yet, you know, they pull over a music promoter in Utah or Nevada, and he has $40,000 on him. You know, they pull over a businessman, you know, making a payment on some property in Georgia, he's got $20,000 on him. You know, how do they know to target, you know, so specifically sometimes, you know, and we are very concerned that over the last couple of decades, you know, millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars have been seized by the government using secret investigations that ultimately result in some kind of highway stop. It's a massive money grab, and Congress needs to find out how much of it has been going on.
I would guess that you're more likely to be stopped with a large wad of cash if you were, let's say, black or Latino, then you're a white businessman, even though you'd be both, all may be engaged in the same legal business.
Yeah. Well, let me give you an example. You know, say I am a businessman in Houston. You know, I do businessmen with people in Japan, Korea, and the Philippines. You know, since I'm doing business with those people, any contact, phone calls, and email that I send to my business associates in other countries can be intercepted by the NSA.
And they can give information, your private information, to somebody else who may even be a competitor.
Yeah, you know, say I tell, you know, my business associate, you know, hey, I'll be coming over, you know, or, you know, I'll be in Miami, you know, with the cash for your product, or, you know, I'll be able to take you out and, you know, make a pitch. You know, the government now knows that you have a bunch of money on you and you're going to be at a certain place at a certain time. And you know, they can target you for forfeiture. What are you doing with this $20,000 in your pocket? What are you doing with this $5,000 in your pocket? You know, they can stop you, arrest you, seize your money, and take it.
And if you don't happen to be well-dressed, it's even more likely it'll be taken away. Oh, hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Good show. What's the website on forfeitures?
if you want to get more information about asset forfeiture, there are two places I would go. One is the website for my organization, Americans for Forfeiture Reform. That's forfeiturereform.com. So forfeiture.com. The second institution, one of her major institutional partners in this advocacy, is called the Institute for Justice. And there, you can check them out at ij.org. And they've done some very meaningful scholarship on the issue, kind of putting the abuses of civil forfeiture into a, is putting out several reports on the subject that, that have been very useful.
There was a seizure I'm aware of, an investigative reporter with the Press Democrat newspaper named Paul Dolan, or Paul Nolan, N-O-L-A-N. Evidently, someone in Annapolis had their assets seized. Annapolis is in the northwest corner of Sonoma County, and a jealous deputy sheriff didn't like this guy, turned him in to the DEA. They rolled over his place, stole $1 million in assets, never pressed charges, and Paul was outraged and was telling me about this story. So this is going on in this area, and it's really sad. So the website again is forfeiturereform.com.
Forfeiture Reform, R-E-F-O-R-O-M, forfeiturereform.com.
Okay. Thank you very much for the work you're doing.
Thanks for the call. We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
I've got two questions for your guest. One of them is, why is cash money illegal at this point in time in this country? And the other is, if I, say, was going to drive to the Bay Area to, like, say, buy a car or a boat, if I take out, you know, $8,000 from the bank or, you know, $12,000 from the bank, can I get a receipt from them that says, you know, this is legitimately my money, which would prove that it was my money, and they couldn't say, okay, well, you can just forfeit this money and we'll let you go?
So I'll answer the second question first. Yes. In the event that you're seized, that you're searched, and your property is seized, having a receipt for its provenance is a very valuable thing to have, especially if they do seize your property and try to put you through a legal process. Because you'll have to try, you know, one of the things that they'll try to make you do is prove, you know, where it came from, how it was paid for. So if you have a bank receipt for your money, you know, that pretty much shows that you got your money from the bank, and, you know, it's all traceable, you paid your taxes, and, you know, that's generally, I think, what you might want to take to court with you. To go back to your first question, why is cash money illegal? Well, the government has this, first off, they want your money, so they'll use any excuse they can to seize it. second, this is really an outgrowth, again, of the war on drugs. You know, the government says that they can seize your money if a drug dog alerts to it, because a drug dog is detecting, you know, quote-unquote, drug residue. Who knows what that is? But the scientific theory that they're relying on is completely bunk. It's bank. It makes absolutely no sense. To give you an example, drug dogs are often trained to identify a compound known as methylbenzoate. Methylbenzoate is one of the compounds that you find as cocaine, for instance, degrades. So they say it's a marker for, you know, cocaine or similar drugs. The problem is methylbenzoate is pervasive in nature. It is produced by funguses. It is produced by all manner of, you know, plants and biological processes. It's all around. So to train a drug dog to alert to something that's all around in nature, or, you know, in someone's car or whatever, is completely bankrupt. You know, unfortunately, the Supreme Court seems to be giving a lot of credibility to drug dogs. But we think that there is some room to challenge the government's theory of why and how money is contaminated with quote-unquote drug residue, and undermine, you know, this completely nonsensical system where the government can manufacture probable cause to take your money. Does that kind of answer your question?
He's off the air, and we're just about off the air. Eben, I want to thank you very much for coming on the air with us today at Takes on the World and for the fine work you're doing.
Thank you very much.